the fortunes of war favored Hrothgar. Friends and kinsmen flocked to his ranks, young followers, a force that grew to be a mighty army. So his mind turned to hall building. He handed down orders for men to work on a great mead hall, meant to be a wonder of the world forever. It would be his throne room, and there he would dispense his God-given goods to young and old, but not the common land or people's lives. Far and wide through the world I have heard orders for work to adorn that wallstead were sent to many people. And soon it stood there, finished and ready in full view, the Hall of Halls. Heorot was the name he had settled on it, whose utterance was law. Nor did he renege, but doled out rings and torques at the table. The hall towered its gables wide and high, and awaiting a barbarous burning. That doom abided, but in time it would come. The killer instinct unleashed among in-laws, the bloodlust rampant. Then, a powerful demon, a prowler through the dark, nursed a hard grievance. It harrowed him to hear the din of the loud banquet every day in the hall, the harp being struck and the clear song of a skilled poet, telling with mastery of man's beginnings, how the Almighty had made the earth a gleaming plain girdled with waters. In his splendor he set the sun and the moon to be the earth's lamplight, lanterns for men, and filled the broad lap of the world with branches and leaves, and quickened life in every other thing that moved. So times were pleasant for the people there, until finally one, a fiend out of hell, began to work his evil in the world. Grendel was the name of this grim demon haunting the marches, marauding round the heath and the desolate fens. He had dwelt for a time in misery among the banished monsters, Cain's clan, whom the Creator had outlawed and condemned as outcasts. For the killing of Abel, the Eternal Lord had exacted a price. Cain got no good from committing that murder, no, because the Almighty made him anathema. And out of the curse of his exile there sprang ogres and elves and evil phantoms, and the giants too who strove with God, time and again until he gave them their reward. So after nightfall, Grendel set out for the lofty house to see how the Ring Danes were settling into it after their drink. And there he came upon them, a company of the best asleep from their feasting, insensible to pain and human sorrow. Suddenly then the god-cursed brute was creating havoc, greedy and grim. He grabbed 30 men from their resting places and rushed into his lair, flushed up and inflamed from the raid, blundering back with the butchered corpses. So Grendel ruled in defiance of right, one against all, until the greatest house in the world stood empty, a deserted wallstead for 12 winters, seasons of woe. Beowulf. Welcome everyone to Professing Literature. In the month of June, a beautiful summer day in the year of grace 2021, and we are coming to you from Oklahoma City. We're glad you're with us. Professing Literature is the podcast where we look closely at key passages of major literary works in the hopes of seeing writers in action and understanding what's going on. I'm David Anderson, Associate Professor of Renaissance Literature at the University of Oklahoma. And with me, of course, is Eric Williams. Hello, Eric.
Hello, David.
Well, we are back in harness doing our thing. It feels good. How is the summer treating you so far?
You know, we've had some pretty hot and humid days, but the past couple have been...
They've been glorious.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah,
not bad at all. And we've got the independence of the nation to celebrate in
Indeed.
A few days.
Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, it took me a while as a Canadian to adjust to the 4th of July because it had not been on the menu growing up. Canada Day is on the 1st of July, so close enough. But I've really come to love the 4th. Any traditions that the Williams family partakes of or that you're especially fond of?
Yeah, well, my wife's family, they do this big fireworks shindig. They haven't done it the past few years, but it's just kind of a typical get-together, picnic, food. But what's glorious about it is the amount of fireworks her father purchases and sets off. And so once I joined the family, I was welcomed into the family, and then he allows me to participate in, you know, designing these fireworks to go off to music. And wow. It's awesome. It's so much fun.
So he synchronizes it kind of in time with the music. So yeah. When you get a sort of crescendo, there's a flourish of...
I mean, a lot of it is... this year, he was looking at purchasing some equipment that would time it. You know, you basically set it up, you put the music to it. Because before, we've just timed it out as best we could with fuses. And our saving grace in all of this is that it's just there's so much fireworks going off that it overwhelms the senses. And so people come away going, so if it's timed music well or not, it doesn't matter. It's just... You come away going, that was a ridiculous amount of explosions.
This is a real production.
It is. It is. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, it's amazing. Why that goes together with celebrating Independence Day, I don't know. But it is the same in Canada. We have fireworks for Canada Day on July 1st. But the delight that Americans take, not just in watching fireworks, but so often in orchestrating them and setting them up is pretty winsome.
Yeah,
it's a great hobby.
It really is. It's a lot of fun. And you're right. There is something in the American spirit, even that is today. Like if you remember last year, it was COVID, of COVID, and a lot of places were like, you can't do fireworks. So like in California, I remember seeing this horizon shot, and I think L.A. And there were, I've never seen so many fireworks over such a wide area. Yeah. So people were just like, sorry, we're lighting fireworks. So
what better way for the human spirit to assert itself against that horrible virus than to unleash like that?
Yes.
I'm all for that.
Yes. So I think, this year, I think we really need to make up for it.
Take back the 4th.
And wasn't it, there's a quote by John Adams. Where he's talking about that they've just signed the Declaration of Independence, I believe, or somewhere in that vein, and that future generations will look back upon the day, there will be pomp and circumstance, there'll be explosions in the sky, there's something like that.
While you were saying that, I pulled up the quotation from Google. So Adams says of the day, and this is a letter to Abigail, his wife. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore. So that's excellent.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Wouldn't old John be pleased? Whatever other regrets he might have about the way his descendants have managed affairs, they certainly know how to mark the 4th of July. That's fantastic.
So very true. Yeah, I always think about that. When I read that, I'm like, wait, is that?
It kind of means that the fireworks aren't just fun, but the right thing to do.
Right.
In capital letters.
Right.
It's sort of whether you feel like it or not. But that's good. That whets my appetite. Well, it's also, I will say, as an aside, it's, I think, very appropriate for our subject today. because we are talking about Beowulf, and part of that discussion will involve the idea of community and the things that bring community together and bind people together. The Anglo-Saxons did not have gunpowder. I think reading this poem, you get the impression that fireworks are something they would have understood. But I also want to say, before we plunge in, a reminder to anyone listening to us, your life will be easier if you subscribe to the podcast, of course, on whatever platform you prefer, and rate us and review it. We are not too good to ask you for a review or a rating. And I don't know, I'm especially partial myself to the 5-star ratings. You know, it's not for me to put that on anyone. But if you feel the itch, please do go for it. We will be eternally grateful for that. And then we do have an email address, as I think we mentioned last time, Eric, if anyone would like to drop us a line and maybe make a suggestion or a query. You know, praise, of course, would be very welcome. Warm commendations, anything like that, or in all seriousness, questions. I think Eric mentioned last time that we contemplate doing the occasional Q&A episode if we get a nice critical mass of questions or contrary views, gently phrased. But what is that email address, Eric?
It is professingliterature@protonmail.com, and it will also be in the show notes.
Excellent. All right. Well, there we are. Housekeeping finished, and we can talk about this strange and wonderful poem. We are going back to the beginnings, more or less, of English poetry with this heroic poem. Beowulf is the great poetic masterpiece of the Anglo-Saxons, or at least the surviving masterpiece of the Anglo-Saxons. We have a certain amount of shorter poetry that survived from the Anglo-Saxon period, and certain works are very powerful and wonderful. But Beowulf is special. It's by far the longest work of poetry which has survived from the Old English era. So this is that part of English history between the end of the Roman Empire in Britain in the 5th century. These Germanic tribes, the Jutes, the Saxons, the Angles, were steadily invading Britain and colonizing it. And so for the next 600 years or so, we think of the period as the period of the Anglo-Saxons in Britain, the period where the English language was in its infancy. And so we speak of that as Old English, the language spoken by the Anglo-Saxons. If you're not used to it on the printed page, or if you heard it recited by someone who knows how to speak it, it wouldn't sound like English. It would probably be easier to learn for a native English speaker than most languages. But it's the early Germanic base of our language. And then, of course, after the Norman conquest in the 11th century, we move into the period of what we call Middle English, the high point of which, in literary terms, certainly was Geoffrey Chaucer. And then by the 16th century, we're in the period of Modern English. And so that includes our friends Shakespeare and Milton and Spenser and Sidney and Wyatt and others. And so we're going back to the beginning in looking at this strange, long poem at a couple of pieces from it. Beowulf is a heroic poem. It could be loosely regarded as an epic poem, although only if one were speaking in a general sense. It has certain important things in common with the epic tradition of the classical world, the Greek and Roman world, although much is different. It's characterized by heavy alliteration in the verse form. In the original, every line is marked out by 3 or 4 stressed words which begin with the same letter. That's hard to do in translation and usually doesn't work too well if the translator is too pedantic in trying to capture that rhythm. But the translation we're reading today was done by a sensitive translator who is able to capture some of that alliterative effect without being too heavy-handed. So, you know, a line like one I read a few minutes ago, speaking of Grendel the monster, greedy and grim, he grabbed 30 men. So it's not an accident that you're hearing those G, or in particular, those GR, gr sounds, greedy and grim, he grabbed 30 men. That's the music of the poetry for the Anglo-Saxons. The translator we are reading, the person who did the translation we're using today, is another of our friends, Seamus Heaney. Around about the year 2000, he produced for Norton a translation of this poem that was a bestseller. It was in every bookstore and remained there for years. And there have been other good translations since then. But Heaney's sort of brought Beowulf back into the consciousness of the reading public, maybe in a way it had never been before. And so I was talking to a friend of mine a few days ago, a friend named Paul, and mentioning that we were going to talk about Beowulf on our next episode and use this translation. And he reminded me that the first time either of us read it was actually me reading it, or at least about half of it, two-thirds of it, aloud on a cross-country trip from Kingston, Ontario to Halifax, Nova Scotia, when I was, well, we were both in our early 20s, and I'd forgotten that, but we were traveling through central New Brunswick, through a huge forest on a road called the Renouse, and we decided to entertain ourselves. He was driving, and I was reading it, and it actually was kind of the perfect setting, if you subtract the car, for reading Beowulf, because it was just, we were surrounded by these towering trees on this very rough, narrow logging road as we were making time, tearing along on the way to Halifax. So remembering that in the context of this discussion today was kind of nice for me. It is a miracle that we have this poem at all. It survives by the merest chance. It makes you think of other masterpieces that might have been circulating in Anglo-Saxon England that did not survive. But we should be very glad we have it. We have it because of a single copy, probably written down by a monk in the 10th century. It survives in what's known as the Noel Codex, a book that was actually damaged in a fire in 1731. And so smoke and fire damaged the poem, meaning we're missing several lines and some line endings. But it sat in a library for hundreds of years, or probably a couple of different libraries. And it was only in the 18th and 19th centuries that people came to appreciate that this was an important artifact and that it had scholarly importance, that it was an invaluable historical and linguistic treasury. But it also tended to be seen as a crude and simplistic monster story. So that unless one was interested in it because of what it said about Anglo-Saxon culture or the history of the English language, there was no reason to read it. It was only in the first half of the 20th century when J.R.R. Tolkien, one of the great scholars of Anglo-Saxon England, gave a paper, Beowulf, the Monster and the Critics, that it began to be viewed as a great work of art, because that's how Tolkien saw it. So it was written down in the 10th century, more than 1,000 years ago, maybe early 11th century. We don't know when the poem itself was composed. It was written down more than 1,000 years ago. It may have been written, it may have been composed, invented by the man who wrote it down. It seems likely, though, that the poem he wrote down was one that at least in some form had been handed to him, possibly with a much earlier origin. I think scholars speculate that it may come from somewhere as early as the 8th century. So the Beowulf problem is a little bit like the Homer problem. We have a poem that was probably designed or probably born as oral poetry. And so it was something that was born by being chanted by the scop, the poet, before the king and the warriors in the mead hall under the torchlight. We see scenes like that within Beowulf. But whenever it was composed, let's say it was composed in the 8th century AD, it looks back to a much earlier world, also like Homer. Homer writing in maybe the 8th century BC is writing of a world that's much older. He's going back to the Trojan Wars, and this is, of course, whether Homer is an individual or a kind of historical committee of people. The Iliad and the Odyssey are looking back to a much earlier heroic age, the age of the Trojan Wars. And so the Beowulf poet is looking back to a time centuries earlier when the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxons, the Old English, were still in their Northern European, Scandinavian settings. The two main people groups in the poem are the Danes and the Geats. The Danes, of course, based in modern-day Denmark, the Geats across the water to the north in modern-day Sweden. The poem describes how a tribe of the Danes had flourished for a little while under their great king, Hrothgar, about whom you heard some things at the beginning, but are then assailed by a terrible monster named Grendel. And the Geat nobleman Beowulf, a famous warrior, sails across the water to aid them. So there is some ancestral memory that the Anglo-Saxons have of this earlier phase of their collective history that this poem is conjuring up. And so it's telling a story of the pagan Germanic peoples in Northern Europe around the Baltic. There is also, it's curious, and you might have caught a flavor of this when I was reading the opening passage, there is a Christian sensibility that has been imposed on this earlier pagan story. We have repeated mentions of God, of the Almighty, and a few other biblical allusions. The most vivid one, of course, is the one to Cain, which I recited to you, that Grendel, this demon creature, is a child of Cain rather than a child of Seth, the line of Adam and Eve's third son, Seth, who populate the world. And so we're looking back at this earlier pagan time. We're looking at it through a lens that's at least to some degree Christian, although there's a real argument among people who talk about the poem as to whether there's a strong Christian perspective that's coming from the poet or just a weak one that's kind of, you know, a thin layer of Christian paint. It seems strong enough to me, but it's very much an open question. Anyhow, we've got a monster story. We've got a story about a man named Beowulf, a great heroic, larger-than-life figure who is a monster killer. There are three monsters in the poem that he fights. First, Grendel, then Grendel's rather unappealing mother. He goes under the surface of a lake, of a mere, and finds her in her cave and fights her and defeats her. And then the poem ends with Beowulf's combat with a great dragon, which is the inspiration for Tolkien's The Hobbit, this great dragon that sleeps on a huge hoard of gold, who is awakened when a piece of his treasure is stolen by a thief. And so how childish is that? We've got this monster story, and we are supposed to be too sophisticated in the 21st century to take monsters seriously. And of course, Shrek taught us that there are no such things as monsters. There are just people who are different. And, you know, the moral, of course, the ending of Shrek, as I recall, it's been a couple of decades since I saw it, but Shrek is not transformed into a human at the end of that movie. Rather, the woman he loves is transformed into a kind of troll creature like him. In the 1970s, an author named John Gardner published a novel called Grendel, which tells the story of Beowulf from the monster's perspective and treats him as a kind of sympathetic existential anti-hero who is raging against the machine and who is misunderstood. And now, I want to be clear, there are good reasons for our sensitivity in this day and age that would have us counter the monster narrative. Of course, there are good reasons for that. Reasons for why we would and do see the outsider figure with greater sympathy, maybe, than our ancestors had always been capable of. But there's also another side to this that we maybe have trouble appreciating. How could anyone look back on the 20th century, for example, and not think there are monsters, not think that evil is real and is more than just a metaphor or a misunderstanding? The message of the poem, it does seem to me to be a broadly Christian message, but there is certainly no prosperity gospel here that's offered as an antidote to these monsters. God in this poem is not looking to help you live your best life. The question is much starker and more severe. It is something like, will you take up the fight for meaning, for truth, for goodness? Will you protect others in the face of inevitable suffering and death? And maybe to put it another way, what do we individually and collectively need, not only to survive, but also to live well in a hostile world? There's a passage from another work, another major work of the Anglo-Saxon genius, the Venerable Bede's Ecclesiastical History, that comes to mind when I think about this poem. That's maybe useful for giving us a sense of the way the Anglo-Saxons view life and the world and their duties. It comes from, Bede is telling the history of the Anglo-Saxon people and especially of their Christianization. He's writing in what, the 8th century, the 7th or 8th century. Someone's going to write in furiously and remind me that I don't know what I'm talking about at this point, but Bede is writing of the Christianization of Northumbria, which is his part of the island of Great Britain, modern-day Northern England, in the 7th century, in the reign of King Edwin of Northumbria. And Bede describes how missionaries come to the king in his mead hall and present the gospel to the king, this otherwise pagan king. And the king consults with his advisors and with his priest, his pagan priest, or one of his priests, who says the following. It's a very moving and a profound passage. The priest tells the king, "The present life of man upon earth, O king, seems to me, in comparison with that time which is unknown to us, like the swift flight of a sparrow through the mead hall, where you sit at supper in winter with your aldermen and thanes, while the fire blazes in the midst and the hall is warmed, but the wintry storms of rain or snow are raging abroad. The sparrow, flying in at one door and immediately out at another, whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry tempest. But after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight, passing from winter to winter again. So this life of man appears for a little while, but of what is to follow or what went before, we know nothing at all. If therefore this new doctrine tells us something more certain, it seems justly to be followed in our kingdom." So that is this pagan priest's rationale for why his people should accept this new religion. But the reason I bring it up now is because of the picture of existence it presents, which it seems to me is, you know, in general very powerful, but also says a great deal about the way the Anglo-Saxons thought about life. We have this brief time of life, which he says is like a sparrow flying through the mead hall from winter, before birth, into winter, death. And now we have this little time of life, this time where there can be warmth and light and community. And so the Anglo-Saxon world is a dark world. It's a world where the crust of civilization is extremely thin, and life is lived close to the bone. The technology of the Anglo-Saxons in many ways is much more primitive than that of the Romans who had come before them. The Anglo-Saxons, you get traces of this in Beowulf, especially towards the end of the poem. The Anglo-Saxons inhabited this island filled with great ruins of cities and Roman building works that they believed must have been built by giants, because it was beyond them to build anything like that, or at least it was through most of their history. By the 11th century, even before the 11th century, but certainly by the 11th century, they were starting to learn the craft of building in stone on a larger level, but not in the way the Romans had mastered it. Life is lived close to the bone, as I say, and the fabric of civilization, that network that keeps us from being brutes in the forest, each man for himself, is extremely thin. And so maybe in light of that, the Anglo-Saxons deserve some credit at least for seeing certain things very clearly. As I said, when I was referring to Tolkien's thoughts on the poem, there is a moral and spiritual seriousness that underlies these stories of monsters. And I think, as I also said already, the idea of monsters is something that we should take seriously. In this world, we have to contend with natural evil. In other words, tragic, terrible things that just happen for no reason. Hurricanes that wipe away homes, cancer that wipes away life. Those things are monsters. And of course, we also have human evil. We have tyrants. We have mass shooters. The Anglo-Saxons lived for generations with the threat of the Viking longships, which would come to their shores every few summers on terrible raids, leaving blood and devastation in their wake. And so this poem is about what it means to live well in the face of that. How do we combat the suffering that is a part of life for human beings? The poem offers a few different solutions. First of all, and this goes to the Christian dimension of the poem, we invoke the Almighty's aid. We recognize that we need God. We need something larger than ourselves to help us. And so the piety in the poem is not maybe of an especially sophisticated kind, but over and over again, we have the idea that we have to call out to God, who alone can intervene definitively in our affairs. Beowulf in this poem is a kind of gift of God given to the Danes. Beowulf is the tallest, he's the strongest, and he is able to slay monsters. And he does so in the first half of the poem, not on his own behalf or even on the behalf of his people, the Geats, but on behalf of this neighboring people, the Danes. He comes to them when he hears of their plight, and he saves them first from Grendel and then from Grendel's mother. And so Beowulf is a kind of manifestation of grace. One could maybe emphasize that unduly, but Beowulf is something who comes unexpectedly from the outside and saves this people. Another way in which we combat the suffering and the evil in the world is through right conduct, through doing what is right. That is one of the ways in which we can buttress ourselves, gird ourselves against suffering. And so Beowulf is a hero in this poem, not simply because of his strength and because of his capacities. He is a hero because he does what is right. And so the poet says in the middle of the poem, "Thus Beowulf bore himself with valor. He was formidable in battle." So, okay, we expect that. That should go without saying. yet behaved with honor and took no advantage. He took no advantage. Beowulf will be showered with gifts. He will be very successful by the end of the poem. He will have ruled for decades as a king. But in aiding the Danes, he takes no advantage. He never cut down a comrade who was drunk. I always liked that line. You know, that's the mark of a true hero, that he doesn't cut down a comrade who was drunk. He kept his temper, so he controls himself. And warrior that he was, watched and controlled his God-sent strength and his outstanding natural powers. So he is not just a manifestation of power, but of rightly ordered power. And he comes to the Danes as a friend. And at the end of the poem, when he has to face the dragon as an old man, as no longer the pure burning force of nature that he once was, still as we are to understand, still he's still immensely strong and formidable, but he's not the man he once was. And all of his companions, except for one, will flee when the time comes to confront the dragon. Only he and his young kinsman, Wiglaf, will remain. And so those companions who flee are shamed, and they are ashamed because they do not stand with him. They fall under judgment. Beowulf, at the end of the poem, will sacrifice himself in fighting the dragon. He will defeat the dragon, but he will be killed. But he fights the dragon at the end of the poem because it is right to do so, because that is what the king is called to do. And then the third, I think, piece of advice that the poem offers us on this problem of how to conduct oneself in the face of suffering. You have beseeching the aid of the Almighty. You have behaving rightly, justly. And you're also warned, and we'll see this in the passage we're going to look at, you're warned against ever imagining that you are above the world of suffering. This is a poem about death and change. And it's not telling us how to transcend those things or escape those things, but how to weather them. And so one of the ways in which we do that is not by imagining that these things can't touch us, but by sort of living with a seriousness that they are out there, and that if they approach us, we are called to face them honorably and justly and courageously. The passage we're going to spend most of our time on comes in the middle of the poem. It comes after Beowulf has defeated first Grendel and then Grendel's mother. So the Danes are celebrating. They are feasting. It's a time of thanksgiving. It's before Beowulf takes ship and returns home, where we're told he will eventually become king of his people and then fight the dragon. So it comes in between, sort of at the halfway point, roughly, of the work. And it's sometimes referred to as Hrothgar's sermon or Hrothgar's exhortation. Hrothgar is the king of the Danes that we heard about in the opening passage. He's an old man at this point. In his day, he had been great. He had been a great leader of his people in war and in peace, and he had built the great hall, Heorot, as his capital, as the center of his power, and as a way of proclaiming the greatness of his rule and of his people. But then for years, Hrothgar has endured the devastation of his people by the monster Grendel, a devastation that he could not save them from, and nor could any of his great men. They couldn't save the Danes from this. Only this outsider coming in friendship, Beowulf, was able to do it. And so Hrothgar's perspective at this point is fascinating. And he's going to offer counsel to the hero who has just saved them. He showers Beowulf with gold and with gifts and with praise. They honor him. They feast Beowulf and his companions. But one of the gifts that he has for Beowulf is this sermon, which is a warning. So I'm picking it up after a couple of dozen lines, launching in, not in the middle exactly, but towards the beginning, but it's already been underway. And I'll read it now. Hrothgar says to Beowulf, "So learn from this and understand true values. I, who tell you, have wintered into wisdom. It is a great wonder how Almighty God in his magnificence favors our race with rank and scope and the gift of wisdom. His sway is wide. Sometimes he allows the mind of a man of distinguished birth to follow its bent, grants him fulfillment and felicity on earth, and forts to command in his own country. He permits him to lord it in many lands until the man in his unthinkingness forgets that it will ever end for him. He indulges his desires. Illness and old age mean nothing to him. His mind is untroubled by envy or malice or the thoughts of enemies with their hate-honed swords. The whole world conforms to his will. He is kept from the worst until an element of overweening enters him and takes hold, while the soul's guard, its sentry, drowses, grown too distracted. A killer stalks him, an archer who draws a deadly bow, and then the man is hit in the heart. An arrow flies beneath his defenses. The devious promptings of the demon start. His old possessions seem paltry to him now. He covets and resents, dishonors custom, and bestows no gold. And because of good things that the heavenly powers gave him in the past, he ignores the shape of things to come. Then finally the end arrives, when the body he was lent collapses and falls prey to its death. Ancestral possessions and the goods he hoarded are inherited by another who lets them go with a liberal hand. O flower of warriors, beware of that trap. Choose, dear Beowulf, the better part, eternal rewards. Do not give way to pride. For a brief while your strength is in bloom, but it fades quickly, and soon there will follow illness or the sword to lay you low, or a sudden fire, or surge of water, or jabbing blade or javelin from the air, or repellent age. Your piercing eye will dim and darken, and death will arrive, dear warrior, to sweep you away. Just so I ruled the Ring Danes' country for 50 years, defended them in wartime with spear and sword against constant assaults by many tribes. I came to believe my enemies had faded from the face of the earth. Still, what happened was a hard reversal from bliss to grief. Grendel struck after lying in wait. He laid waste to the land, and from that moment my mind was in dread of his depredations. So I praise God in his heavenly glory that I live to behold this head dripping blood, and that after such harrowing I can look upon it in triumph at last. Take your place, then, with pride and pleasure, and move to the feast. Tomorrow morning our treasure will be shared and showered upon you." So that's Hrothgar's sermon. This is the counsel he gives to this young man who has come and saved them. And it's a rich and interesting statement. Learn from this, he tells Beowulf at the outset. This is a piece of counsel that he wants Beowulf to take seriously. And the implication that follows is that it's unnatural counsel, in a way, for one in Beowulf's position. It's the thing he doesn't, or it's the thing that a person in Beowulf's position is not likely to want to hear. But it's the thing he needs to know. And Hrothgar suggests that his mandate for being able to say this piece, this hard truth, comes from the fact that he is old and that he has lived this. In the wonderful phrase that Haney gives us, He says that he has wintered into wisdom. You know, that is the deal. That is the deal that so much of our contemporary culture wants to ignore. The idea that the young get the good looks and the physical strength, and the old get the wisdom. And Hrothgar wants to be heard now because he has gone through life. He is approaching his winter time, his time of death. And so he is able to see what he hadn't been able to see. He starts with a very sort of wide-angle perspective, talking about the human being's creation by God, that God has given our race, human beings, rank and scope and the gift of wisdom. This is what we have that is our particular blessing and benefit. And so we need to hang on to it and pay attention to it. Hrothgar says, sometimes God will favor a man, a noble man, a man of distinguished birth. This is a hierarchical society. And so, just as in the Homeric tradition, the hero, it goes without saying, is someone of a noble lineage. But every once in a while, God will give a person who has all of the gifts of birth and ability, elbow room, scope, the ability to fulfill his desires and to be happy and to rule. Hrothgar says he permits him to lord it in many lands. He permits him. This is something that the Almighty makes possible and allows. In other words, it is not the intrinsic property, possession of the individual, but it's something that God has permitted. But when that happens, things can go wrong. And we're maybe reminded of those Old Testament kings like David and Solomon, who were men of great virtue and abilities, but who, after reigning for years and years, grew in different ways complacent and forgot about who put them on the throne. Something similar is at stake in what Hrothgar is describing. The man in his unthinkingness forgets that it will ever end for him. So that is unwisdom. Unwisdom or folly is imagining that one's state of blessedness is one's intrinsic property and that it will never end. And so this man indulges his desires. Hrothgar isn't counseling asceticism. He's not suggesting that Beowulf is to flee his desires like a kind of eremite, to avoid them, but one is not to complacently indulge them. Illness and old age, Hrothgar says to the man in this position, the man with this mindset, mean nothing to him. So this person, this hypothetical ruler, forgets that, as Charles Barkley puts it, Father Time is undefeated. He thinks nothing of illness and old age. And so this is, you know, the Greek term, which you're probably familiar with, is hubris. Overweening pride, and a kind of folly in the face of existential realities. It's dangerous for kings as well as for anyone else. And so this person forgets about enemies who will be sharpening their swords for him. He believes, Hrothgar says, that the whole world conforms to his will. And that's a dangerous attitude to be in. You know, Silicon Valley tycoons, statesmen, men of wealth and power and influence can be tricked into thinking that the whole world conforms to their will. But that is not the way the world works. So this foolish man, Hrothgar suggests, is marked out by an attitude of overweening, of believing excessively. And so that anesthetizes him from reality, but only up to a point, because reality will break in. The soul's guard, which is supposed to be wisdom, goes to sleep. And the man does not realize that he is being stalked by an archer. That wonderful image Hrothgar gives. A killer stalks him, an archer who draws a deadly bow. So just think of that, the proud man not realizing that the archer is out there already lining him up, aiming that arrow at him. So what is the archer and what is the bow? It seems from what Hrothgar goes on to say, it is an element, he's not in this passage describing death or suffering. Those come later. He's rather describing the archer who's aiming the arrow at him is, he's a figure of discontent because the arrow that hits this man in the heart is the devious promptings of the demon, to use Hrothgar's language. And so the person who lives in this state of complacent folly not only has the wrong, dangerous attitude that he is inoculated from pain and from loss, that's bad enough, but that's the very person Hrothgar suggests who will, as he puts it, covet and resent. Resentment is a deadly force in this poem. It is the attribute of all attributes that most defines Grendel, the monster. Grendel is a figure of resentment. He is not just, the poem tells us, a figure of chaos, of physical antagonism. He's not the equivalent of a grizzly bear who just wants a meal. He's a figure marked out by resentment, who hates Hrothgar's people and wants to stamp them out, not just stamp them out, but make them miserable. He's a figure of resentment. And Hrothgar is suggesting to Beowulf in a way that we might find kind of unexpected, that at least one of the breeding grounds for this sort of covetous resentment is complacency, is the belief that one is above reality. Because if I can, because of my greatness, consider myself inoculated from pain and suffering and simply above it, then why don't I have even more? And so the demon, as Hrothgar calls him, pricks us, pricks the man in that position. And now the man is not satisfied. And so what does he do? What's the next thing it leads him to do? Well, he dishonors custom. And this is a poem about custom. Custom binds us together. It gives us roles to play. It keeps us, it regulates our expectations as well as our behaviors. And it makes the world meaningful, even in the face of disappointment and trauma. And so to dishonor custom is to commit a great sin. And the king is supposed to be the one who not simply heeds custom, adheres to it, but embodies it and perpetuates it and encourages it. One of the ways the king does that, and this is an interesting thing, it comes up over and over again in the poem. We tend to think quite simplistically that the feudal, medieval, or even more primitive king is just a kind of taker figure. He is one who is self-aggrandizing, who takes what the peasant has and pulls it into himself. But the vision of kingship we have in this poem is that the king is the font of gifts. He is a gift giver. And there is an implicit circular economy here. Of course, those lower down the pecking order kick up. They give of what they have, you know, primitive kind of taxation in exchange for the king's protection. But the king is supposed to give them not only protection, he is supposed to give them gifts, not just in an arbitrary way, but gifts as rewards for fidelity and good conduct and good works. And so Hrothgar, we are told repeatedly, and Beowulf himself, when he becomes king, they give gold. They give gold rings. This is a people that do not have a system of coinage. And so it seems in the poem that the sort of unit, not exactly of currency, but of sort of specie value, is the gold ring. And the king is the giver of gold rings. And he's not doing that in order to show what a nice guy he is. He's doing that because it's a duty incumbent upon him, that his gift giving strengthens the bonds between the community. And so the figure of resentment, the complacent one, does not do that. He ceases to do that. He doesn't understand that he's a contingent being. He doesn't understand that he's frail and is not invincible. And so therefore, he's resentful at the fact that he doesn't have more. And therefore, he stops participating in this customary system of gift giving. Hrothgar goes on, because of good things that the heavenly powers gave him in the past, he ignores the shape of things to come. Really beautiful phrase. He ignores the shape of things to come. He can't know the future, but his responsibility is to understand the nature of human life, which dwindles. It does not remain in a fixed and steady state. There are no plateaus. Father Time is undefeated. And so Hrothgar says, finally the end arrives. Finally the end arrives when the body he was lent collapses and falls. Again, another very powerful phrase, the body he was lent. Whatever exactly the metaphysics or theology of this poet is, to whatever degree they can be called Christian or maybe something else, but certainly theistic, a phrase like that tells us that one's personhood is not one's property. It's the body is not a possession that I can do with as I like. It was lent to me. And there's a certain amount of sense in that. I don't remember asking to be born. I don't remember designing my own body. I wound up in it. And all of a sudden, around about 2 years old or something like that, started recognizing consciously that I was in it. But as the poet puts it, it's something lent. In other words, it's not for all time. And so the body he was lent collapses and falls prey to death. Ancestral possessions and the goods he hoarded are inherited by another. And so this man of power who had taken and who had been discontented and who had wanted more and who had tried to hold on to everything that he had instead of giving what was extra, what King Lear calls the superflux, the additional, that which is not necessary and therefore can be given to those who have less, will have it all taken away. It will all go away, and they'll be inherited by another, Hrothgar says, who lets them go with a liberal hand, so who will recognize that they are there not to be hoarded, but to be circulated. The individual in this poem has to have community to thrive. There are other powerful Anglo-Saxon poems. I'm thinking of The Wanderer and of The Wife's Lament, which describe the situation of the exile as just about the grimmest fate that can befall a person. That is the Anglo-Saxon nightmare, to be isolated and alone and cut off from community, because the individual needs community in order to thrive. And what is good for me also has to be what is good for everyone else. And so the sermon concludes. Hrothgar says, beware that trap, to Beowulf. And he suggests that Beowulf will have a choice. Beowulf has the power, the potency, the stature to be the man whom God seems to favor. But that will impose upon him a choice. And his choice is a kind of choice of imagination. Is he going to imagine that his life is defined by a sort of steady state of permanent power? Or is he going to recognize, to use that earlier phrase, the shape of things to come? That is the choice that Beowulf is going to face. And Beowulf, when the dragon comes, will no longer be the proud young warrior who's eager to face it in order to make a name for himself. He will be the bent old gray warrior who nevertheless gets up off his throne and recognizes that his duty is to go right into the guts of the dragon's lair and face the monster again, even though we can sense he knows that it will be his death. And so the choice that will face him, as I say, is a choice of imagination. How are you going to imagine your own self in the world? That's what you are going to have to decide. And so Hrothgar says to him, it's very poignant, "For a brief while, your strength is in bloom, but it fades quickly." You know, think of a professional athlete, even a great professional athlete. Those of you who watched The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary, will understand what I'm talking about. I was a child of the 90s. I remember Jordan's greatness, 6 titles, whatever it was, 13 or 14 All-Star game appearances, all of those MVPs, the sense that he had a kind of magical power that no one on a basketball court had ever had before. And not meaning to cast aspersions on the present day Michael Jordan, but, you know, he's not that man anymore. Doesn't mean his life is over, doesn't have value. Wish him all the best. He might have a chance to be happier in the future than he ever had been in the past. But he is no longer that young 20-year-old who seems to be able to fly, or that 30-year-old who knew, you know, who could use the fadeaway jumper and all of the old pros veteran tricks to still remain a force in the game. He's retired, and he's been retired for a while. "For a brief while, your strength is in bloom, but it fades quickly." And so, you know, we all know the stories of the professional athlete who acts as though today will never end. A lot of them in that situation don't think much about saving money. And then, I'm not saying this is Jordan at all, but for some of those cases, there's something, you know, quite sad and pathetic about them. They're 40 pounds heavier, their knees don't work anymore, and they didn't put any money away. It's not just athletes who face that kind of problem, but it's particularly vivid maybe in those cases because in their time of blooming, when their strength was in bloom, they have been so impressive and so dominant and so spectacular. Hrothgar continues, "Soon there will follow illness or the sword to lay you low, or fire, or flood, or a blade, or," he says, "repellent age." If it's not any of those other sort of catastrophic things, old age will do the trick. And so the eye that now is so bright, the hair that is so bright right now, the back that is erect and unbowed, all of those things will be degraded and you will be swept away. And so we have this poignant sense of the kind of passing beauty of a figure like Beowulf's greatness, that for a little while he is in full flower. And it's spectacular, but it's not going to be that way forever. And there is something tragic about that fact, that even before he dies, or even before any specific kind of suffering is foretold for him, long before the dragon makes his appearance, the simple fact of age is a matter of grief. And so for Tolkien, this poem is an elegy. In other words, it is a kind of melancholy lament, not just because Beowulf dies at the end of it after facing the dragon, but because Beowulf is only at his greatest for a little while. And then what happens to everyone else happens to him. And so there is this real, maturity in this poem, in the way that it looks at this absolute certainty of change. What can remain when that beauty and that strength go is wisdom. Wisdom is something that can be held on to. And again, that rings strangely in a culture like our own, which since the 60s has been possessed by the idea of eternal youth. The cult of advertising has been very successful in making people in the West believe that youth and health and abundance and wealth and comfort are normal, and that their opposites are abnormal. It's part of why it's so isolating for people who don't have those things in our society. Not just because it is hard to be without those things, objectively hard, but because the messages we get from the culture tell us that those things are abnormal, and therefore the person who is old or impaired or alone or unsatisfied is not just dealing with an objective problem, and fair enough, but is a kind of outcast figure. You know, what's wrong? What's wrong? Commercials tell us, advertising tells us, the movies and television shows and music that is pumped into our lives every day tell us that beauty and sexual satisfaction and fulfillment of every different kind are not just prizeworthy things that should be valued, that should be appreciated, but that they are normal, and to not have them is abnormal. And as a culture, we have done our best to insulate ourselves from anything which might tell us otherwise. And, you know, people, more eloquent people than me, have talked about this, but, you know, death and suffering are kept out of our faces. They're rare events for the average American or Canadian or Westerner. Death was all around you in the Anglo-Saxon world. Anytime a meal was served, you know where your meat comes from in the Anglo-Saxon world. But you also confront death, as people of all cultures did up until about 100 or 150, maybe, although I think that's going back too far, years ago. When someone died, you had to deal with it, you and the people in your community. There wasn't a bunch of trained specialists who would keep that away from you and only let you have that little glimpse at the funeral home. When your grandfather died, he died at home, and your family were the ones who laid him out, maybe with some assistance from other people. We don't live that way anymore. And it allows that archer with the bow, loaded with that arrow of resentment, to have an easy shot at it, at us. You know, why shouldn't I always be happy and in command and have even more? And so Hrothgar says, concluding, he reminds Beowulf that for 50 years he was a king, and he defended his people. And he came to believe, he says, I came to believe my enemies had faded from the face of the earth. Bitter experience tells him otherwise. It's not that Hrothgar is not saying I wasn't a great king. He has no false modesty. But he's saying something was out there which was beyond me. And he calls it a hard reversal. The monster came, and so for something like, I think, 10 or a dozen years, his people were in hiding, and there was a kind of gloom over his land, because every night Grendel would stalk out there in the darkness, and whenever the torches were lit in the hall, Grendel would come. And so they had to live in the darkness. And so Hrothgar says that he can praise God that Beowulf was sent to them in order to save them. And he says that Beowulf now should celebrate and know that tomorrow we're going to pour out our bounty on you. Now we're going to feast. But part of the bounty Hrothgar has to give Beowulf is this wisdom. And so this is a king telling a young king-to-be. Beowulf isn't yet the king of his people, but he will be, and Hrothgar can sort of foresee that this is coming. He's telling this king-to-be what he needs to know. Not to be a great ruler. He's not giving him advice about statecraft or strategy or economic management or man management or anything like that. He's giving him existential counsel about the right attitude that will protect both him and his people. And Hrothgar knows whereof he speaks. The passage we began with tells his story in a few dozen lines, that he was a great man who was fortunate, and after he had consolidated his power, he built this place which was to be his legacy. The poet tells us that one day in a time of civil war, Heorot the Hall will be burned down, so it will not last forever. Nothing that human beings do will last forever. Even the pyramids are slowly, 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 slowly crumbling. Nothing will last forever. And so Hrothgar built this great mead hall, which was not a bad thing. But it wasn't a permanent thing. It wasn't an absolute thing. It wasn't an ultimate thing. While he was ruling in Heorot, he was a good king. And Heorot functions in the poem as a sort of emblem of community. Community, as I said, is what you see is so often treasured in Anglo-Saxon verse. The networks that we build around ourselves that can allow you to flourish as an individual, but also the people around you to flourish also, or at least to have their best possible shot of flourishing. This is a poem that is constantly, you know, it's a poem dominated by these monsters, but the contrast that is offered to the monsters is community. All of the monsters in the poem are figures of isolation and alienation and resentment. And Grendel in particular, in the passage we began with, is angry and resentful because he hears the music that comes from Heorot and he sees the torchlight and it makes him upset. As Haney translates it, he says, it harrowed him. A harrow is a fairly crude metal implement that would be dragged by horses or oxen, or in some cases even by individual people, over a field that had been plowed and planted, a sort of metal frame that would be dragged over the plowed rows to knock the dirt down and flatten it down and sort of immerse the seeds under the dirt. And so to harrow something is to rake over it. And Grendel is harrowed to hear the din of the loud banquet every day in the hall, the harp being struck, and the clear song of a skilled poet. These are things that characterize human community in a dark and hostile world. Light, warmth, music, feasting. You know, feasting is a really important thing in this poem. It's a really important idea generally, whether you're reading the Odyssey or the Faerie Queen or the Bible. Feasting is an important ideal. We are not, you know, food is meant to be shared. It's meant to be eaten with other people. It's an opportunity for sharing. We're taking something that is without and we're incorporating it into ourselves and we're strengthening ourselves as we do so. And we are supposed to do it with others, which does not mean that it's a sin to ever eat a meal alone, but it means that what we are supposed to do, what the meal is supposed to point us to, is one another. And so The people in Heorot feast, and as they feast, they listen to music and poetry. And the king gives gifts, all of these things which make the society work. Grendel hates. And the poet, we're told, is not singing just any song when Grendel's ire explodes. He's singing a song of creation. He was telling with mastery of man's beginnings how the Almighty had made the earth a gleaming plain girdled with waters, set the sun and moon, etc., etc. And so they are singing, they are hearing this song of making, of ordering, of structuring. And Grendel, who represents antagonism to all of that, and antagonism to the structured human community, seeks to destroy it. Beowulf defends it. And Beowulf stands for that principle of community. And Hrothgar wants him to understand that it's his duty to himself as well as to his people to be aware of his own limitations and frailty. So, that was quite a big picture account of a couple of passages of the poem. I hope that made sense to everyone. Do you think, Eric, that everyone's just rolling their eyes at this point, or will something of that hopefully have stuck?
I think it most definitely will have stuck. That's, again, I think we talked about it beforehand, but I never read Beowulf. I mean, I remember it in school, and it was like an excerpt thereof.
Yeah,
and
a little flavor.
I really didn't pay much attention to it other than I thought it was probably boring.
Yeah.
But I thought everything was boring in school, personally. But anyway, so yeah, it's really fascinating. Again, it's yet again, I'm intrigued to actually go and read it now.
Yeah, like in some ways, we couldn't be much further from any people as we are from a people like the Anglo-Saxons. They are so distanced from us in time. But also, you know, the Greeks and the Romans were much older than the Anglo-Saxons, the Egyptians. But their societies, as we look at them, as we look, you know, whether it's through archaeology or modern historical accounts, you know, the Romans in particular seem so like us in so many ways. They have this sophisticated civilization. The Anglo-Saxons have something much more primitive. And yet this poet is speaking about themes which, if you slow down and look at them, they're so resonant and good medicine also for us. There's nothing, I don't think, at least as I read something like Hrothgar's sermon, I'm not overcome with a sense of gloom or anything like that. It's sobering, it's realism, but the emphasis is on the good life, which is also the wise life. And so there are things here for us if we'll slow down and look twice, maybe. Well, everybody, I think that about does it for this episode of Professing Literature. Thank you so much. Comments and questions welcome, of course, at that email address, which you can find in the show notes. I'm David Anderson, and on behalf of Eric Williams, thank you for joining us, and all the best. Goodbye.